I'm Thorne Dreyer, and this is Rag Radio. We come your way on KOOP 91.7 FM every Friday afternoon from 2 to 3 p.m. We also are rebroadcast now on WFTE in Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania, every Sunday morning. So welcome to all the folks out there in Pennsylvania. We also stream live on the World Wide Web, and so, again, welcome to everybody wherever you are. And thanks for listening to Rag Radio. If you want to get in touch with us, our email address is ragradio@koop.org. And every show, including this one, as soon as Tracy gets it up, will be up at the Internet Archive as a downloadable podcast. My engineer and cohort, compatriot, is Tracy Schultz. Tracy, welcome more time.
Thank you. Always happy to be here. Appreciate it.
Okay, cool. I'm always happy to have you here. It's always fun. Robert H. Frank is an economist and New York Times columnist. He's an economics professor at Cornell's Johnson Graduate School of Management. He's an Economic View columnist for the New York Times and is a distinguished senior fellow at Demos. His books, which have been translated into 22 languages, include The Winner-Take-All Society with Philip Cook, The Economic Naturalist, Luxury Fever, What Price the Moral High Ground, and Principles of Economics with Ben Bernanke. Robert Frank's latest book is The Darwin Economy, Liberty, Competition, and the Common Good, in which he contends that naturalist Charles Darwin was a greater economist than Adam Smith. According to author Francis Fukuyama, Frank, quote, takes particular aim at the notion that a well-functioning competitive market system will necessarily produce socially optimal results. In The Darwin Economy, Frank argues against Adam Smith's theory of the invisible hand, which says that competition channels self-interest for the common good. Quote, the uncritical celebration of the invisible hand has undermined regulatory efforts to reconcile conflicts between individual and collective interests, causing considerable harm to all of us. I want to mention that Roger Baker, my friend and colleague, is a Rag blog contributor, especially in the area of economics, will be joining us later in the show to ask some questions. Robert Frank, welcome to Rag Radio.
Thanks for having me on with you, Thorne.
It's great to have you. You know what? I want to talk about this. We'll start out talking about the current book and your theory and the whole question of the invisible hand and how you see Darwin as a naturalist as being really the one that we need to look to for direction in economics. But let me start in this way. Tell me, what can we learn from peacocks, elks, and hockey players that will inform us about this issue?
Yeah, that's a great way to start. Each one, I think, paints a vivid picture of a situation in which individuals do what makes the most sense to them, but the result overall isn't very attractive to them once the dust settles. So I think maybe the easiest one of those examples to focus on first would be the hockey players. And this is really an example that I owe to Thomas Schelling, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2006. What he began with was the observation that hockey players always skate without helmets unless there's a rule requiring helmets. But then he noticed that if they had a chance to vote themselves, they would vote often unanimously in favor of a rule requiring helmets. And so his natural question was, look, if you think helmets are so great, why don't you just wear them? Why do you need a rule? And his explanation, I think, really captures the essence of how individual interests and group interests often diverge. So he said that if you're an individual hockey player, taking your helmet off gives you a slight competitive edge. Maybe you can see better, hear better, or maybe it's just that your willingness to skate without one makes it
maybe you just feel more
intimidate
maybe
your opponents. You're nuts enough to risk injury. Let's give this guy wider berth.
Maybe you just feel more macho or something.
Yeah, maybe you just get more self-confident yourself. And so The athletes take their helmet off, hoping to gain a competitive edge. If they're the only ones who do it, they do gain one. But the other side, predictably, doesn't sit idly by for that to happen. They take their helmets off, too. And then you discover yourselves all skating without a helmet. Nobody's got a competitive edge. You all face serious risk of head injuries. And so it seems natural at that point to say, look, what are we doing here, guys? Let's wear helmets. But then if there's not a rule requiring them, you always slip back into the same no-helmet equilibrium. And so they realized finally that the only way to be able to successfully wear helmets when they competed was to have a rule requiring everybody to wear them. And I don't think it's right to think of that rule as something that goes against the wishes of the hockey players. They're not being infringed upon in terms of a hostile government taking their liberty away from them. They realized that this was the only way to get what they wanted. So I think that example makes very clear that this standard presumption, and I should also say I don't really hold Smith responsible for the pronouncements of his modern disciples. Many of them say individual interests can be relied on to serve society all the time. Smith never thought that, but the hockey helmet example is a good reason why that's not a good general prescription. Sometimes individual interest does serve the common good. The standard Smith invisible hand argument was a good example of that. The producer brings out a cost-saving innovation, hoping to steal market share from his rivals and make more money, not because he wants to help society. He does it. It works. He makes a lot of money. But then what happens next is the other producers try to recapture their market share. They copy the innovation as quickly as they can. And the new greater competition from lots of people having the innovation drives price down to a much lower level than before. And in the end, when the dust settles, you've got the consumers, the ultimate beneficiaries of all that churning, not the firms, but the consumers. So the invisible hand often does work, but yeah, not always.
Okay, and it was fun where you talked about peacocks. You talk about the, you know, peacocks like fancy tail feathers, the bright big tail. And you said that the larger tail feather, the more noticeable one was, it attracted the female. It was for mating purposes,
a peacock with a small tail display. That's been shown experimentally. They really like the peacocks with the large, bright tail displays. And the best thinking
that happens in human society too, I think. But go ahead.
Yeah, the parallels there are pretty clear. I guess we could say.
But it's interesting because then you said if all of them have smaller tail feathers, then it's sort of, you don't have to, it doesn't have to be as big, but then it's just relative to that.
Right. To that. Right. Yeah. The problem when you all have 15 feet tail feathers trailing behind you, you're much more vulnerable to predators.
Yes. Yeah.
But if you don't have big tail displays, you don't get to mate with a female. And so you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. And the tail feathers in any event are too big from the point of view of peacocks as a group. They'd all be just as well off in terms of their ability to attract a mate if the tail displays were all smaller by half, but then they'd be way less vulnerable to predators. So it'd be really better if they were all smaller, but not for any one peacock. If any one peacock had a smaller display, he'd never find a mate.
Just like taking off your helmet if you're the hockey player.
Exactly.
Let's back up a little bit now and what, tell us what the invisible hand theory is. Give us
my target in the book is really not Adam Smith himself, but his sort of uncritically enthusiastic modern disciples who say, as the invisible hand theory taught us, we need only get government out of the way and let markets work their magic. And Smith certainly never believed that's all it took. He was amazed that selfish actions often produce good results in the marketplace, which of course they do. I think that's a very important insight. But they don't always. And in particular, I think we really learn a lot from Darwin's more general insight that in many important domains in the marketplace, especially, life's graded on the curve. You know, it's not how big you are, how strong you are that matters. It's whether you're bigger or stronger than your direct rivals. So I think there are lots of competitions where contestants jockey for position. They make all sorts of expensive maneuvers to gain advantage, but those expensive steps they take in the end prove to be self-canceling the same way longer tail feathers in the peacocks do, or the helmets of the helmetless hockey players' moves do.
And you think that the libertarians, who are really defining the terms a lot in economics these days, are that they take this concept and run with it?
Yeah, I think their presumption is that the government shouldn't ever tell you you can't do what you want to do. And I think implicitly they build their case for that idea on the idea that giving individuals complete freedom of action is going to somehow serve society's interests in the most effective possible way. And I think what we learned from Darwin is that actually sometimes that's right, but other times it's not right. There are lots of situations where arms races are the expected result. And in those situations, you know, individual incentives produce behaviors that for the most part are mutually offsetting. They don't achieve any real objective for the group's point of view. And hence they're wasteful. If we could give people a gentle push to rein in some of those kinds of behaviors, we'd have more money to spend on useful things.
Okay, and one of the ways we do that is through intelligent taxation. Is that right?
Exactly. I think many libertarians denounce all taxation as theft. That's really kind of a strange proposition if you think about it for a moment. What kind of country would you have if taxation were voluntary? You know, there would be some people who would pay taxes for a while. Then they'd see that their neighbors weren't paying taxes. They'd feel resentful, and they'd stop paying taxes, too. The government couldn't continue to function. There wouldn't be an army. You'd in short order, be invaded by some other country that had an army that was financed with its own mandatory taxation. And then in the end, you'd be paying taxes to that country's government. So really saying all taxation is theft, that's really like putting a sign around your neck saying, I'm not a serious person. You know, I'm willing to get up on the stump and say transparently meaningless statements.
Well,
we have to have taxes.
There's a lot of people out there in the political arena who would seem to fit that description.
It's amazing. You know, what everybody hates taxes. That's understandable. But what do they think the alternative is? If you're a mature adult, you know you got to tax something. And what I try to steer people to the view is that if you tax activities that cause undue harm to others, you're actually killing two birds with one stone. You're raising the revenue you need to support an army to defend you, but at the same time, you're discouraging people from doing things that they shouldn't be doing anyway.
Yeah, you're mitigating in favor of more positive social behavior. You talked about social engineering and that accusation on the part of the libertarians about social engineering. But you said it's a strange complaint because virtually every law and regulation constitutes social engineering. You said laws against homicide and theft, because they aim to control our behavior, steer our choices, and change the way we live our lives, they are social engineering.
Exactly. Yeah, the only way you could be against social engineering would be to be a complete anarchist. You know, there shouldn't be any stop signs. There shouldn't be any courts. There shouldn't be any laws. But nobody really defends that position anymore. That's been tried. It's failed. You couldn't cobble together a society of people who believe that anymore. So really, you have to take seriously the idea that your right to do what you want to do is hemmed in by other people's right not to be harmed by what you do. Those two things just are inseparable in any kind of sensible view of the world.
And the tied in, I guess, is the fear on the part of I guess, everybody on the political right and the political center is pretty far right at this point in time, is that any kind of government regulations are I guess, anathema to economic growth.
Right. All laws and regulations basically are some variation on the theme, it's government telling me I can't do what I want to do. And And if you really believe that what I want to do is always and everywhere in society's best interest to permit, then that describes the person in the book I call the movement libertarian, basically somebody who just doesn't want to be restrained no matter what the rationale might be. And I don't think it's really possible to make a convincing case on behalf of the idea that you should do whatever you want, no matter how much harm it causes to others, no matter how little you benefit from it. At some point, activities that don't benefit you much but harm others a lot have to be reined in.
Okay. How does all of this, how do we translate all of this to the economic situation we're in right now, to the whole concept of dealing with the deficit, to the, getting us, ourselves, if such can even be done, out
of the... Yeah, there's actually some great news in the simple observation that individual interests and group interests don't coincide all the time. What it means is that since we don't regulate behavior much of the time, individuals behave in lots of ways that impose big costs on others, far bigger costs than the benefits they get from what they're doing. And what that means is that there are opportunities to discourage them from doing those things by taxing them. A tax on any activity has two effects. It generates revenue, yes, that's the obvious one, but it also discourages the activity that you tax. And if it's one that's causing a lot of harm to others, that's something you want to do quite apart from the need to raise revenue. So the fact is we need revenue now. Nobody who's looked at the numbers thinks we can balance our budgets, which we really do need to do in the future, by cutting wasteful government spending. You know, that's been tried. It's failed. What we need is some new revenue, and there are lots and lots of things we do that we do too much of that if we taxed, we would do less of. That would be good, but at the same time, it would generate way more than enough revenue to pay all the debts we've run up and fix our crumbling infrastructure and do lots of other things that we'd like to see done.
This would include, for instance...
That's basically good news.
This would include, for instance, and ideas of things that you tax in order to...
Oh, I had an interesting conversation with a libertarian, the editor of Reason magazine, a month or so ago, and the question came up, should it be okay to tax passenger vehicles by weight? So my take on that is that let's think of a guy who's almost indifferent between a station wagon and a 7,500-pound SUV for his next purchase. So 3,000-pound station wagon, 7,500-pound SUV. The SUV can haul a bigger load. It's got slightly more capacity to put things in the back. Some people need one. Not everyone does. Here's a guy who's just on the cusp. He doesn't really care much which one he buys, but he has a slight preference for the SUV. Well, under current arrangements, why shouldn't he buy it if he likes it a little bit better? But if he buys it, he puts everyone else on the road at greater risk of injury and death. You know, you don't want to get into a collision with a 7,500-pound vehicle. The data are pretty clear that your risk of injury and death are much higher when that happens. And so all I'm proposing in that case is that when you make your decision which vehicle to buy, you take that harm into account. The heavier vehicle, which is more likely to harm others seriously, should be taxed in proportion to the extra harm it's likely to cause, and that would give people making up their minds which one to buy an incentive to take that into account. What's the counterargument? I haven't heard one.
Okay.
You need to tax something, remember.
Yeah.
Why not tax a behavior that people would otherwise engage in too much?
What about people who are extremely wealthy engaging in the negative behavior of greed, of acquiring acquisitiveness?
Example in the consumption domain. Yeah, we know there that there's been some incredible, I think you have to just use the descriptive term, waste in a lot of the spending patterns that we've seen in recent decades. What's happened is that the richest people in society, to begin with, have captured virtually all of the income gains for the last 30 years, and they've done just what people at every income level do when they get more money. They build bigger and better. That's not a moral indictment of them. That's just what everyone does when that happens. But when the rich build bigger mansions, they shift the frame of reference that governs what people just below them feel they need. So maybe now those people who travel in the same social circles as the rich now know it's the custom to have your daughter's wedding reception at home. So they need a house with a ballroom. They build bigger. And then there's a group just below them. They build bigger, too. And it cascades all the way down the income ladder so that now the guy in the middle, the median new house built in the U.S. in 2007 had 2,300 square feet, which was up from 1,600 square feet in 1980. And it's not because the guy in the middle has more money. In fact, his average inflation-adjusted wage is lower than it was in 1980. Why is he spending so much more on a house? It's because people like him are spending more on a house, and that's because of this expenditure cascade. And if you don't do that, if you're the middle guy and you don't spend as much as others like you do on a house, then it's your kids who go to the bad schools, because the good schools are located in the more expensive neighborhoods. But when you all spend more on a house, all you do is you bid up the prices of the houses in the better school districts. There's still 50% of all kids end up in bottom half schools. So that's the kind of waste we've seen. And we can eliminate a lot of that waste, too, without having bureaucrats tell you what you can do and what you can't do. There are simple tax solutions to that, too.
Okay, we need to take a break. My guest is Robert Frank, economist, columnist for the New York Times, and most recently author of The Darwin Economy, Liberty, Competition, and the Common Good. We'll be back in just a second, and I'm fairly soon going to bring Roger Baker into this, at which time you will see the level of discussion go up a couple of levels. I'll be right back. This is Rag Radio. I'm Thorn Dreyer. Okay, and what we want is you to enjoy Rag Radio. We're coming your way. We come your way every Friday afternoon on Co-op and all over the place on the World Wide Web. I'm Thorn Dreyer. My guest is Robert H. Frank, economist, author, and most recently author of The Darwin Economy, Liberty, Competition, and the Common Good. I'm going to bring Roger Baker in just one second, but first I just want to ask you a general question because I'm the layman here, so I can ask the questions that are. How do you respond to those who say that everything from environmental regulations to taxing the rich are disincentives for productivity, are disincentives for hiring people? That whole, which is, I think, part of the basic their basic premise. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, there certainly are many examples of government regulations that are likely doing more harm than good. One thing I stress to my students is that it's not enough just to show that the private market equilibrium you've discovered is not efficient, that it's flawed in some way relative to some perhaps unattainable theoretical ideal. What you really got to think about is whether the clumsy government imperfect regulation that you'll put in place of the pure unfettered market solution is likely to do any better than that. And I think often the answer is no. But I think we've learned a lot, too, about how to regulate more effectively. I think the environmental realm is the one that's given me most of my inspiration about how to go about trying to bring individual and social incentives more closely into alignment. And there, what we used to I think the acid rain problem is a nice illustrative case in point. When I first moved to Cornell decades ago, every day there were articles in the newspaper about acid rain. And the way we used to try to attack that problem was to regulate the behavior of electric generating companies directly. They were the source of the acid rain, mostly. And we would tell them, for example, you've got to buy your coal from this specific county in Ohio because the coal there was low in sulfur content, or you had to install this particular brand of scrubbers on your smokestack. That approach generally was very adversarial. It didn't produce results very quickly. It was very expensive. People complained about it justly. economists had long been arguing for a different approach, which is just one based on this basic idea that individual and group incentives don't always line up properly. The reason we had too much acid rain was that generating companies were discharging SO2 into the air because it was free to do that. We weren't charging them for the right to do that. We were just letting them do it for free. And, of course, they're going to do it to excess if they can impose costs on others and pay no penalty. That's a recipe for them doing to an activity like that to excess. And so the proposal that the economists were pushing was charge them for the right to put SO2 into the air. Once you do that, they'll become geniuses overnight at discovering cheap new ways to filter the SO2 out. So finally, after about 20 years, the economists' recommendations were heeded. We began charging people for permits to put SO2 into the air. And lo and behold, we never read any articles about acid rain anymore. It's not a problem. The air quality targets were met much more quickly than we were on schedule to meet them under the old approach of command and control regulation. And they were met at about one-eighth the estimated total cost of doing it under the old regulatory approach. So the lesson of that experience is that if you've got an activity that's going on to excess, just make it more expensive. Tax it, and then people will decide for themselves if they have alternatives that let them cut back on that activity cheaply to avoid the tax. If they can't find alternatives, they'll pay the tax and do what they were doing. But if they can, they'll become amazingly inventive at figuring out ways to get around the problem.
Okay, and then finally the other part of it, the question of the contention that that by lowering the tax burden on the wealthy, on corporations, that in fact what that means is they're going to go out and they're going to expand their businesses and they're going to hire lots of people and the economy is going to bounce back.
That's what we were told again and again, but you know that very statement contradicts what's found in every elementary economics textbook about the logic of business hiring decisions, including the textbooks written by the people who directly advise the Republican presidents and presidential candidates who are making those statements. What the textbook rule says is that if you're a business owner and you can hire a worker for $100 who will bring in $110 of extra revenue as a result of your hiring him, it makes sense to hire that worker whether you're rich, poor, or middle income. It doesn't matter what your income is. If you're hiring a worker for $100 who'll bring in $90 of extra revenue, it doesn't matter if you're a billionaire, it doesn't make sense to hire that worker. So saying that giving tax cuts to business owners will make them hire more workers just doesn't make sense. You'll hire more workers if they'll bring in more than they cost. Otherwise, you won't hire them. And we've never seen any evidence, either theoretical or empirical, to back up the claim that when the tax rates on the wealthy are higher, they work less hard, they take less care on behalf of their business. There's no evidence for that proposition whatsoever. It's a great benefit to be able to run a big company. People are eager to do it. Many talented people want that job. They'll do it whether the tax rate's what it is now or whether it's 5 or 10% higher. There won't be any difference in the amount of effort people put forward to try to capture those limited number of positions.
Okay, I'm Thorne Dreyer. My guest is Robert Frank. Also with me here is my friend and colleague, RagBlog contributor, Roger Baker. And Roger, I can just see your brain kind of like, so all those cogs are just rolling.
I've been listening for sure. Hello there, Dr. Frank.
Hi, how are you, Roger?
I think, you know, one thing that strikes me is that the modern equivalent of taxing big cars or taxing sulfur emissions would probably be putting out greenhouse gases. Now, that's certainly one of the major problems that we face, but what we seem to see now is that corporations have a lot of influence, and they essentially, you know, have sort of, been able to prevent taxes on greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, I think that we ought to go back to the original term that Adam Smith used. He didn't refer to economics. He referred to the political economy.
Right.
In other words, he saw economics as sort of the flip side of the coin of politics. And I think what you have now is sort of an illustration that if private wealth can control politics, you know, they can control the economy, and that they can circumvent all these, you know, things that might be good policies. Like
that's the biggest threat we face, indeed. I think the campaign finance laws have gotten less strict over time. This particular Supreme Court doesn't seem to view them as a threat to the national welfare, but in fact, the eagerness of legislators to vote special favors for their donors is one of the biggest problems we face in trying to get policy reforms enacted. The only thing that makes me optimistic about it, Roger, is the thought that if we could have a fuller conversation about the choices we face, I think even the business owners themselves, the ones who are now lobbying so actively against regulation, would see it as in their interest to rein in some of the behaviors that they're now engaging in. Yeah, I think if the planet goes under, the MIT simulation model said 2 years ago there's a 10% chance of a 12 degrees Fahrenheit temperature rise by the end of this century. That's the end of the game if that happens. You know, it's much better to have a tax on carbon emissions and choke off that threat than to just ignore the problem because you think you'll get higher short-run profits if you don't do anything. Well, that's true, but if you really studied the relevant data carefully, you'd realize that the higher profits enable you to build a bigger mansion, all of you, but when you all build a bigger mansion, nobody's any happier than before. You've just raised the bar that defines how big a mansion you feel you need.
So, plus you're using more electricity.
Exactly, yeah, you're putting even more SO2 into the air.
Well, the current state we're in, you know, the short run trumps the long run pretty much politically, and I don't see how you get out of that situation.
I had a conversation with a colleague. He was worried about all the taxes he saw coming on people like him and me. He and I both have a successful textbook, and so we're doing quite okay in terms of our finances. He was worried that our taxes were going to go up, and I said, well, you know, you really don't need to worry that much. He said, why? I said, well, do you think they'll ever adopt a change that will threaten your ability to buy what you need? He said, no, of course not. They couldn't do that. Well, what's to worry about then, that they're going to threaten your ability to buy what you want? Yeah, that's what he was worried about. And I said, well, look, people like us, what do we want? We want those things that are in scarce supply, you know, a particular painting, an apartment with a sweeping view of Central Park, or a nice lot overlooking the ocean. Those are the things we bid for and hope to get. If they raise your taxes and my taxes, that won't affect the outcome of our bidding war one iota. The same painting, the same apartment, the same lot's going to end up in the same hands as before. So I think if people would really step back and think about it in that more general way, they'd be less worried to try and protect their pre-tax income from any possibility of being encroached on by a tax on a harmful activity.
Well, I think I can predict that they won't see it that way.
So far, I haven't persuaded them to see it that way from a distance, but whenever I've spoken to a group in the same room for 30 minutes, I've been able to get a majority on my side saying, yeah, we ought to be taxing these things in the way you suggest.
One thing that I notice that you advocate is a progressive consumption tax, and that seems akin to sort of the progressive income tax. Could you explain the difference or why
it would be better? It looks almost the same, in fact, but there's a key difference. In fact, 98% of us now live under a progressive consumption tax. The way a tax like that works is you report your income to the IRS. Ideally, that process should be greatly simplified, that we don't need a 3.4 million word tax code to talk about all these exemptions and deductions. So simplify that, but then report your savings for the year. We know how to do that from our 401k and IRA accounts that are currently tax exempt. So you got those two numbers, the difference between them, your income minus your savings, that's how much you spent during the year. So that amount, less a big standard deduction, let's say $30,000 for a family of four, would be your taxable consumption. And then we would levy tax on that number at a very low rate to begin with, but then the rate on the next dollar you spend would keep rising and would quickly eclipse the top rate that we see currently under the income tax. It could be much, much higher without any fear that you'd choke off incentives to save and invest. On the contrary, the higher that rate would be, the more people would want to save and invest. And that would be a really good change to put onto the system because of the changes in spending patterns that it would encourage.
Well, how much influence do these ideas have amongst your economic colleagues and amongst, say, politicians and Congress?
I would say anywhere between zero and very little, but you don't want to give up hope, basically. What Herb Stein said once, always stuck in my memory, if something can't go on forever, it won't. We're right now spending way more than we take in. I think people who say deficits have to be reckoned with are correct in the long run. We've got to get our accounts in balance. And at some point, I think it's going to become clear that that can't be done by eliminating wasteful government spending. Every president in my lifetime has tried to do that, and spending rose in every administration so far. And with all these baby boomers retiring in the next decades, it's going to continue rising. If we're going to balance budgets, we're going to need new revenue. That's absolutely clear. And so at some point, we've got to think about how to raise it. And at that point, I think a progressive consumption tax is going to be one of the options that we're going to consider very seriously. I did a paper about it 15 years ago, and shortly after it came out, I got a nice warm letter from Milton Friedman, the patron saint of small government conservatism. He said he didn't think the government needed to be raising more revenue. This was back in the mid-90s when budgets were in better shape. But he said if the government did need new revenue, the progressive consumption tax would be the exactly correct way to get it. And he enclosed a reprint of his own article from the 1943 American Economic Review in which he'd proposed a progressive consumption tax as the best way to pay for the war effort. So I think there really is a good chance that at some point we'll see bipartisan support for an instrument like that.
Okay, we need to take a break again. We just got an email from Milton Friedman saying that it's time to take a break
from,
here.
The great beyond.
My guest is, we had some sort of Twilight Zone kind of music going in the background. My guest is Robert Frank. My colleague who's also joining us is Roger Baker. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio. I'm Thorne Dreyer. This is RAG Radio, and my guest is economist, New York Times columnist and author Robert Frank. Roger Baker is also with us here in the studio. We just got an email question from David McBride in Berlin. David said, noting that we have not only the monetarized market motivated by self-interest and government, we also very much economic activity involves the motivation of caring, empathy, what he says we in tradition is called women's work. He said, can you estimate how much economic activity is motivated by self-interest and how much by caring for others? He said, where can it be the case and where not that the more you share, the more you have?
Yeah, that's actually a subject I've studied directly for many years. And one of the interesting metrics that we can bring to bear on a question like that is everybody, I think, would like to come home from work at the end of the day and say to himself, I didn't make the world a worse place by what I did today. Better still, I helped make the world a better place by what I did today. Some people care about that a lot. Other people don't care about that nearly as much. And many, unfortunately, don't seem to care at all about that. But we know that some people care a great deal about that because the theory of the labor market predicts that the more pleasant a job is viewed as being, the lower wage it has to pay in order to attract people to fill it, other things equal. And so from studies of the labor market that I and others have done, it's probably the most important single characteristic about a job that predicts differences in wages. So if you think about a job that is widely viewed by people as a socially beneficial job, a job where you're making the world a better place in some tangible way, typically the wage sacrifice that you see in jobs like that is way bigger than the one explained by almost any other working characteristic. So we see by that indirect footprint in the data that people really do seem to care a lot about helping others, leaving the world a slightly better place as a result of what you did. Not everybody, but certainly a lot of people.
Somewhat related to this question, before we get back to Roger Baker, and related to what we were talking about before the break, you said essentially that there, for much of big business or whatever, it would actually be in their interest, should they be capable of looking at the larger picture and thinking in terms of the long run. And this would certainly be true in terms of the world's ecology, that the kinds of things we're talking about, the downsizing, and would be actually in their interest. But in order to look at what's in the greater, what's for the greater social good and for the good of what we now are referring to as the 99%, are those who are not in control of the means of production. What about the times that those interests actually don't coincide? What about the times that those who own and control our economy or our business, the large businesses, what about when the changes that are to meet the social, and I'm sort of stumbling through this, in order to meet the larger social good are not in their interests, and we have to make some decisions between interests?
Yeah, I think that's where we've run aground so often in the public debate in recent decades, especially with the increased influence of powerful actors on the political decision-making process. So you'll see a company or a firm who thinks it will be harmed by regulation and has the power to block it. I think in the healthcare reform debate, there were many vivid examples of just that sort. So the idea of relying on private insurance companies to provide healthcare access to a population is really just about the worst possible system you could design for that purpose. Virtually no other country tried to do it in the way we did it. The incentives facing private insurance companies are just to get rid of anybody they think might need care. That's the overwhelming survival imperative for a company like that, because if it gets stuck with the patients who need a lot of care, its expenses go up and it can't possibly stay in business. So what I argued during that period was, look, if the insurance companies have the power politically to block moving to a more rational system of healthcare provision, the one that virtually all other industrial democracies use and which ends up costing taxpayers about half as much as the one we have. If they have that power, let's just acknowledge that and say, we're going to buy you out. You didn't enter the insurance business with evil intent. We know it's just a question of the competitive imperatives that make you try to get rid of sick customers from your insurance rolls, and we want to shift to a more sensible means of providing care to people, and we know it's going to cost you to be out of the business that you've worked to build, and we're going to just buy you out. We're going to give you a payment to compensate you for the losses you're going to suffer for getting out of the way. So I think sometimes it really will, as you say, be against the interest of a player to get out of the way. And in those cases, if they have the power to block change, then we, rather than say there's nothing we can do, we should work out a deal.
Okay. We're talking with Robert Frank on RAG Radio. I'm going to pass the conch back to Roger Baker now.
Okay. Let me ask a question which is sort of academic, shifting gears to, you know, the history of economics. We do know that Marx and Darwin were contemporaries, and we also know that Marx was a great admirer of Darwin.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that Darwin, you know, was appreciative of Marx. And I just wonder, you know, it seems to me like it would be like it's appropriate to focus on what differences there might be between your concept of Darwin being, you know, a great economist and how Marx might figure into that picture.
Yeah, I think, in fact, Marx was a great admirer of Darwin's. Darwin was not, as many people seem to think, a social Darwinist. This was the late 19th century movement that misread Darwin, in my opinion, as having said, whatever survives under competition is morally praiseworthy. We should celebrate it. That was not Darwin's position. He understood, as Marx did, that competition made inevitable certain kinds of behaviors that didn't seem at all consistent with the interests of the broader groups. I mean, think about the behavior of the alpha lion when he ascends to the leadership post in the pride. The very first thing he does is to murder all the cubs sired by the previous alpha male. It's a brutal process to witness. It's misery on steroids, and yet that brings the females into heat more quickly. It spreads his genes, and so competition makes behavior like that inevitable. Darwin realized that, and he didn't think it was such a great thing to celebrate. It was just a fact of nature, and I think he was, by all accounts, a very humane man, and I think Marx, too, saw that individual interest didn't always promote the common good. I think he didn't have a very clear sense of why it didn't promote the common good. I think he could have learned much more from Marx than he did. I mean, he thought you got bad outcomes in the market because monopolists exploited everybody, and that's really not the problem, as I'm viewing it. I think Darwin's vision was that even if you had no monopoly, perfect competition, just like the textbooks assume, you would still get these arms races that are so incredibly wasteful for the actors involved. And so I think that Marx did not learn the essential lesson that I think Darwin had to offer.
Well, it seems to me that the concept of class struggle is closely related to the survival of the fittest.
Yeah, that's true. And I don't think Marx thought that class struggle led to good outcomes in every instance, and I don't think Darwin thought that survival of the fittest led to good outcomes in every instance. Again, good as defined from the perspective of some larger group. The class struggle ended in Marx's day with the people on top winning, and it's headed in that direction again.
Right, exactly. You know, it's like history repeats itself, but it's still the same patterns are going
right
on now.
But that doesn't mean it's a good thing.
When you talked about social Darwinism, basically, and its rise back in the day, it's certainly back in the vogue now. And why is it so popular? Why does it have such an appeal? And how do we respond to it?
You know, we've had three decades of rhetoric celebrating the idea that if you'll just get government out of the way and let individuals do what they want, you'll get the best possible outcome for society as a whole. And that's the essential idea of social Darwinism, isn't it? It's that if it survives under competition, it must be all for the good. And that's manifestly not the case. And I think the more we talk about it and the more we see the sources of divergence between individual and group interests, the quicker we'll steer clear of that unproductive path. That's not really a good path to be going down.
Well, of course, the arms race figures into this, too. You know, if it were purely the marketplace, that would be one thing. But there's guns involved, you know, in the international scale. And that,
exactly.
That's not a level playing field economically when those factors enter in. I'll tell you one thing.
I appreciate that.
One thing that I'm really, you know, focused on personally is the role of peak oil. And I know that you're probably an economist that doesn't look at that, but I'm really, you know, focused on environmental limits. And that sort of harks back to Malthus a little bit. You know, Marx was not really tuned into that, but now we're seeing that there are global limits, and we're sort of, I think they're causing a lot of the problems that we're seeing in how the economy operates.
Yeah, and I think, interestingly, Darwin was very heavily influenced by Malthus. He learned most of the economics he learned directly by reading Malthus. And so the notion of limits and species extinctions was very much in the front of Darwin's mind. As an economist, the idea that we will run out of oil, the moment of peak oil is soon upon us if it hasn't already come, is a less threatening idea than it is to many people, just because the experience has been throughout that when we start running out of something, it gets much more expensive quickly, especially as the end becomes more confidently predicted, and as the price of it rises, that stimulates or always has stimulated a productive search for alternative ways to do what you were doing with the thing you're about to run out of, and at some point maybe we'll run out of escape hatches like that. But I think the best hope for being able to cope in a world of scarce resources is for them to be allowed to get more expensive. The idea of keeping gasoline and oil artificially low priced is just a very strange notion. Do we want to encourage people to use more of it when the supplies are so obviously limited? That seems like exactly the wrong thing to be doing. Granted, prices make it hard for the poor, but there's lots of ways to help the poor other than artificially depressing the prices of the things that they buy.
But what if we've gone too far before we have that voila moment? What if we, you know, I mean, how many times can we hang on the, you know, at the precipice and suddenly, come up with some kind of new technological way of dealing with the problems that we've created? We're dealing with something right now, and when we talk about the world's ecosystems especially, we're talking about something that we go beyond a certain point, and it's going to be real hard to find some way to respond to that, to deal with it.
Right. Yeah, the main thing is to have the Earth not burn up with the climate change problem. But you know, if we had to go back to the Stone Age, we'd go back to the Stone Age. I don't think we'll have to do that with renewable energy sources being developed.
But don't you think we'll have to?
If we had to, we could go back to the Stone Age and live more simply. That wouldn't be the end of existence as we know it.
But don't you think we have to start thinking in terms of downsizing our whole approach to the way we live and the way we interact and the way we run our commerce?
Oh, we must do that, and the surest, most effective way to do it is by making the things that are getting scarce more expensive.
Are you familiar with the Kenneth Boulding quote? He says that the only ones who believe in exponential growth in a finite world are madmen and economists.
Yes. Yeah, he was marvelous, Kenneth Boulding.
Okay, we're about to run out of time here. This has gone very fast, as it always does when we have
time
sort
flies
of
when interesting... you're having fun.
That's exactly true. Roger, do you have one more closing thing, because we've just got a couple of minutes?
Well, I would say that you know, we may be in a situation now. I just see Paul Krugman thinks that the euro is finished in Europe, and you know, I think there's growing concern that we may be headed for a world depression.
Yeah, I'm worried about that myself.
Okay, we can see that there's a lot of stuff that we are legitimately worried about. Whatever. Whoever we turn to as our gurus in terms of especially economics, but what do you see our doing now? What is your approach, and what do you think that people who are listening in should do? What can they take from all of this?
You know, I think the main message is that because we haven't recognized clearly how big a gulf there is between individual spending incentives and our overall interests as a society, we're spending our limited resources now in ways that virtually do no good for us. The bigger mansions don't make anybody any happier. The more expensive weddings and coming of age parties don't either. If we could change tax policy in a way that would scale back spending in those domains, we could free up resources that could be put to good uses. And nobody would have to give up anything important to. Nobody would have to sacrifice any important political freedoms. No downside.
So okay, we're down to just a few seconds. Where can people find out more about your work? Website?
The Darwin Economy. Do a Google search on the Darwin Economy. That'll turn up the Facebook page for the book, which has lots of content on it. And if you search my name, you'll find my website, which has more.
Okay, cool. Thank you very much, Robert Frank, being with us on RAG Radio. Roger Baker, thank you for being with us.
Okay, thank you.
And we'll be next week, nonviolent activist Val Liveoak of Peace Building in Las Americas, then singer, songwriter, and activist Eliza Gilkison. After that, environmentalist and climate change activist Bruce Melton, and RAG Radio's New Year's special, SDS founder and progressive political activist Tom Hayden will be our guest. So thank you very much for being with us. RAG Radio is produced in the studios of KOOP Hornsby Austin in conjunction with the RAG blog, theragblog.blogspot.com, and the New Journalism Project. I'm Thorne Dreyer.